During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.
Right.
Kid. Kept going on about how great this stupid city is. I tell you, I've been here a minute and I don't see it.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 585 for the week of October 20th, 2025. I am detective who never learns that suspects run away, David T. Cole. And I'm here with bean eater, Sarah D. Bunting.
I hear of the hyenas plot, beaniness.
Defense attorney in a police procedural, Tara Ariana.
Oh, don't worry. I'm just sitting here. I'm not going to say anything.
And expository dialogue, expositing the same thing for the third time, Margaret H. Willison.
That's right. I'm white, she's black, and we're sisters. Do you get it this time, or do I need to draw you a diagram?
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she's a writer and a podcaster you've heard with us before. It's Margaret H. Willison. Welcome back, Margaret.
Hi, friends.
We're so thrilled to have Margaret here to talk about Boston Blue, in which... Yeah. Sean Reagan, Mika Amundsen, member of a New York criminal justice system dynasty he couldn't join because of LOL NYPD budget cuts, has been forced to move all the way to Boston so he can also become a cop. When he runs into a fire to save civilians and gets badly injured, his father Danny, Donnie Wahlberg, makes the trip to see him, taking long breaks from his ICU bedside to work the case Sean intervened on with Lena Silver, Sonequa Martin-Green. Like Danny, Lena is also part of a local criminal justice system dynasty. Her late stepfather was a judge. Her mother is district attorney. Her stepsister is superintendent of detectives. And her half-brother is a beat cop who is Sean's best friend. They even have regular family dinners to hash out the case of the week. Danny fits in so well. Is there even any reason for him to go back to Brooklyn? The show is co-created by Brandon Margolis and Brandon Saunier, neither of whom worked on Blue Bloods, although they were co-showrunners on the Bad Boys spinoff show LA's Finest. We watched one. Only one episode of Boston Blue has aired so far on CBS. We got access to two, but we'll try not to spoil events from episodes that have not aired yet. Let's do the Chen check-in. Margaret, should our listeners watch Boston Blue?
I think if you're inclined to watch Boston Blue, like, you know who you are and you know what it is.
Yep.
And it is mostly what it seems like. If you are like, hey, I've heard some things about these Blues, but I don't really do police procedurals. Maybe I'll give it a try. Don't.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Don't do that. Don't do that to yourself.
Yeah.
Sarah.
No. Like, even if you were a Blue Bloods guy.
Okay.
No.
No. Wow.
Dave.
I mean, I guess I should just defer to Sarah on this one, but I thought the answer was going to be you had 17 years to test out the waters with Blue Blood. So if you're in with that, I guess you'd probably be in for this because it seems like it's probably the exact same show down to like the family where everybody has to be a cop. You know, oh, here comes Fido. You know, he's on the bomb squad. You know, everybody's a cop here. So that I guess would be my answer, although, and no, I'm gonna have to say, if Blue Bloods expert slash the world's number one Blue Bloods fan Sarah D. Bunting can't muster the energy for this,
really?
I may have to reconsider.
If I wanted to watch a cop show set in Toronto, I would just watch Law and Order Toronto : Criminal Intent, because this pilot sure was shot in Toronto. At least parts of it were.
Thank you for answering that question for me, because it certainly wasn't shot in Boston.
No. It was not. Normally we go to the guests first, but since Sarah is, as we've said, the Blue Bloods watcher on the panel, Sarah, how well or poorly does Boston Blue broaden the world of Blue Bloods? Sounds like poorly, but tell us precisely why.
If you watched Blue Bloods or found it soothing to just like have on that every episode was kind of the same, first of all, you can still do that. It was on for 180 seasons. I'm not sure why they bothered canceling it if Boston Blue is the result.
Right.
But it is what it is. It's a very standard pro-cop, few bad apples, procedural, fine. Mm-hmm. And there is obviously a place for that in American cultural life and people who find the rhythms of that soothing. Mm-hmm. But there was absolutely no need to cancel the original, give Donnie Wahlberg a terrible dye job, and move everything to Boss Tronto. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, they're acting like Boston is not Boston, but Bahrain. Like, there are conversations between two cops and two cop families talking about, like, oh, we have that in the Catholic church at home. Oh, mm-hmm. really? You're telling this to a Bostonian. They have a couple Catholics there. I mean, they're not good at diversing in Boston, I wouldn't say, especially that they're known for that. But they have all these things there that this whole, like, cross-cultural fish out of water. Like, how far out of water is a New York cop fish in the Charles River?
Seriously.
Not very. Also, everyone knows where fucking Donnie Wahlberg is from. Yeah. Are you fucking kidding me? It's doing all the same things, like, structurally and rhythmically as Blue Bloods, but because that is in reruns on at least three channels right this second, mm-hmm. and it's not doing some of the things as well. There's some really good actors in here. For what? I don't understand why this exists, and the exposition really was so tiring. Like, God. You know, but I've seen A Blended Family before. The Bunch of Brady. Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not realize that the show was sort of grew out of the corpse of Boston Blue. I assumed, you know, that they were both continuing on adjacent to one another. And in that sense, I feel like McDonald's, like, Caribbean Spice version. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see that being something some folks might want to tune in for, which, for context for folks, instead of it just being like a standard Irish Catholic cop family, this is a blended Jewish Black family.
Right.
Where the grandfather is also the head preacher at, like, Boston's oldest Black Baptist church, mm-hmm. where the gospel choir sings in kente cloth robes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which Donnie Wahlberg also acts like they don't have in New York City.
Right.
In fucking Brooklyn, of all places. Like, I just can't. Only on TV.
I was like, well, this feels like a bold choice. Because as a Bostonian, going into watching one of these shows, I'm always like, well, is this going to be about Boston that I live in? Right. Or is this going to be about, like, someone's fantasy of Boston from between 1975 and 1995 mm-hmm. with, like, Whitey Bulger
right.
and, like,
right.
everybody in Southie is still poor uh-huh. and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what I found is that this is no place.
Uh-huh.
It's not the new Boston I live yeah. in now. It's not the fantasy Boston people like to make movies like The Town about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a random placeholder that mm-hmm. occasionally isn't New York, but again, yeah. never looks much like Boston. I especially like in the second episode, there's a murder at Fenway Park and there are yeah. some scenes that are shot in Fenway Park. And then suddenly they're on a street outside Fenway Park. And I'm like, that's just not, that's
no.
nowhere.
Yeah.
Mm. That's not what anything outside Fenway Park looks like.
Yeah, this show has mm-hmm. all the fidelity of, like, when Top Chef goes somewhere, you know, and it's just like it's exactly the same show in a studio, except, yeah, we got a lobster roll the first episode, you know, like it's like that level of detail.
Right. So I was originally yeah. I was going to give them points for, like, oh, well, I guess we've set it in a diverse place. But I did feel like, are the people who wanted to watch something called Blue Bloods, like, do they want their copaganda with, like, Seder dinners on Friday night?
Uh-huh.
Or do they want their copaganda with, you know, corned beef on Sunday, just like they've always had it? Mm-hmm. I suspect yeah. probably the latter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, CBS, I think, does know one or two things more than I do about what shows are going to have longevity.
Yeah. Well, we'll see, I guess. I found it interesting that on the copaganda tip, like, the law enforcement shows that we've recently discussed on the podcast, which include Task, High Potential, Slow Horses, and The New Force, all of those on our bonus episodes on Fridays and Extra Extra Hot Great, they all start from a seeming assumption that the audience mm-hmm. is suspicious about cops and needs to know that the show's creators are as well. But, like, mm-hmm. this really felt like a throwback to an era in which none of that was happening. Like, one of the major plot points and the reason for the crime in the first episode is racist facial recognition software, and we're told it is bad and we're not going to use it unless you really need to. And also, we got a black software engineer to help us fix it, so don't even worry about it.
In this, it seems like the thing it wants to reassure you about is, oh, don't worry, even though these main characters are black, they aren't going to be woke about policing.
Right.
Right. They still want to use the facial recognition software. It's just their loony mom, who's the DA, who's trying to make a stunt here.
Yeah.
Also, in that particular one, it's like they have a very clear image of the suspect's face.
Yeah.
It's like you couldn't just like hold up the picture and look at the suspect and be like, well, that looks like that's probably the suspect. You have to wait for like the panes of the face to be scanned by the facial recognition software and the little loading bar to come up and be like 72% match.
All the polygons that make it sciency. It's like we have facial recognition software. It's called Vision. Eyes. Someone put on some spectacles and look at the suspect.
Yeah. But also when they're like, well, that's a match, 72%. I'm like, I don't think that's so much of a match personally. And it turns out not to be. But like,
it's a second act red herring is what that is.
Sure right. is.
And we all knew it would be based on the timing.
Yeah. We've watched TV before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially police procedurals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We already talked about Donnie Wahlberg's dye job.
But I kept looking at him and being like, is he a Wahlberg?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, because he looks a little bit like if you poured Ike Barinholtz into a glass you just drunk Mark Wahlberg out of. Right? And I was like, he's probably a Wahlberg. He can't look this much like a Wahlberg and not be a Wahlberg. But for the benefit of all involved, I didn't Google, and I'm pleased to hear I was correct.
I mean, the Wahlbergs are all kind of melting at this point. You know, they're all in their 50s. It's fine. But I did think it was funny that his reveal, his first scene in character is like shirtless near bed. It's like, okay.
Uh-huh.
You've been to the gym. Great. Glad you feel strongly about making sure we all know. But also getting caught in the maelstrom is Sonequa Martin-Green, who has been the best thing about almost everything I've ever seen her in, including this. But the best I can say, even with that standard, is I hope she's getting paid a lot because she's
I
so
really
much better
she
than she needs to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's so hard to be a black woman that cool and consent to having Donnie Wahlberg repeatedly refer to you as Beantown.
Yeah.
Which I gotta say, like, it's really, like, it's not a thing. It's not a thing anyone says.
No.
I mean, it is. It's a thing an 83-year-old person to whom I am related says.
Might say. Right, might say. Yeah.
Might say. He also says bow socks and shy socks. He's 83. Don't be 83.
There's like a gumshoe shorthand, though, or a cool guy loner thing where he calls you by the city you live, like Sawyer and Lost, or probably somebody from The Walking Dead did it, too. That
no kind
of guy. You know, how you doing there, Toronto? It's like,
Yeah. I did watch this and wonder, like, I'm against using AI to make shows. I'm against it. I don't know that it couldn't have done a better job.
Mm-hmm.
Or the same, yeah.
The same, absolutely the same. Mm-hmm. Like, no question about that. But when you're talking about somebody whose house is in Hyde Park, and you're like, yeah, and he took the red line there, like, maybe at least just, like, pick a neighborhood of Boston that is connected to the subway. Any subway, right? Mm-hmm. Like, any subway at all. But instead, they picked one that's only on a commuter train. And obviously, needless to say, nowhere near the red line. Whereas the primarily black neighborhood in Boston of Dorchester is huge and contains almost all of the red line. Just seems like that's actually a detail AI might have gotten right. AI probably, however, would have sent a perp running through a historic cemetery that is famously surrounded on all sides by buildings and does not have any abutting alleys, such as the one you eventually see him fleeing into.
Wow.
That feels like an AI problem. But other things, like I don't want to Boston Police, the Boston Police show.
But it is kind of weird when you have a show that has location first in the title and you just know there's nobody from that city in the writer's room or the production side of things. Just like one person.
One Google.
You can say something about the red line not going where you think it goes.
Yeah, by one map.
I'm glad that I'm not going to be the only like Massachusetts cop on our family of podcasts, because I make these complaints about Cape stuff and Cape Side on the Dawson's Creek podcast all the time. And it's like, look, it doesn't have to be like an exact Like, here's the Orleans traffic circuit. Right. Who cares? But at least have some concept of how anything works in a state that's not North Carolina. I don't know.
I mean, like, if you want to be from a place, be from a place.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Like, The Good Wife, you can tell. I'm going to talk about it later on, so, but I'll bring it in now. It is not shot in Chicago, and you can regularly see. You're like, well, this is certainly Central Park. I'm not even from New York, and I know this is Central Park. But it does really capture, like, you get a feeling of Chicago politics. You get a feeling of, like, specifically the Democratic Party. You feel like you are interacting with people who live in that city, who talk about that city, who think about that city. It has verisimilitude. This has no very, like, this has as much verisimilitude as, like, that one establishing shot in Legally Blonde, where you, like, see her driving over a bridge, and then you're like, it's Harvard. And you're like, we know it's not.
Yeah, this is like ordering stuff from a fancy restaurant on DoorDash. You're just like, you get it there, and it's like, all right, I mean, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. So it sounds like the blue part is boring, and the Boston part is inauthentic. So Boston blue, no thank you.
Yeah, no thank
you. More like Boston boo.
Boston boo.
Got a lot of shows. It's a great time for shows.
All right. Oh, wait. Margaret, how many times a day do you say wicked as a Bostonian? I forgot to ask you that. 7, 8?
Wicked few times.
Okay. It is time for Around the Dial. First up, as always, Tara. Tara, what have you been watching recently?
I watched Downey Wrote That on Peacock. We did not talk about him last week when we covered The Chair Company, but one of the secondary office characters on that show, Douglas, who lets Ron know he was expecting to get the project lead job and who is comforting himself now by blowing tiny bubbles at his coworkers a lot, is played by Jim Downey. Jim Downey is someone who is very important to this podcast because of one clip you have heard us play dozens of times.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
So, you also saw him as an important member of the Christmas Adventurers Club in One Battle After Another. He was also previously in Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood. He is, however, mostly a comedy writer, which is why he is the subject of a new documentary on Peacock, Downey Wrote That, which was produced by Lorne Michaels, who employed Downey on Saturday Night Live, starting basically when Downey was straight out of college in the second season and then on and off for decades afterwards, spanning two centuries. This was fun for me because as much as I shit on SNL, because it deserves it, I was a super fan at one time, including the period when Jim Downey worked on it. So seeing clips of the various sketches that he wrote was enough for me to, like, fill in the whole thing of all of them in my head. But that is probably also why it would be frustrating for anyone who is not off book on the show from the 80s and 90s and early aughts, because the sketches that get highlighted aren't ever shown in full. I felt that way about the segment that covered Downey's time when he was the head writer on Late Night with David Letterman, which, believe it or not, was when I was too young to be watching it. That just maybe which I could find a playlist of his stuff on Letterman, which they may have made by now. They're usually right on top of it on the Letterman YouTube channel, like curating stuff that's relevant to current events in the cultural news. Also frustrating, the filmmaker, whose name is Brent Hodge, he also directed the Adam Pally special on HBO this week. He features a clip of Bob Odenkirk talking about how restrictive Odenkirk found the writing process on SNL when he was on staff. He describes that at length in his recent memoir, and Odenkirk is shown saying he wishes he knew what Downey thought about that, and then we don't hear what Downey thought about it. Like, if you're not going to ask him or if he's not going to answer, just don't include that clip. But speaking of clips, I do have a couple that illustrate what makes the movie worth watching if you are an SNL old head. And before I play this clip, just know it is accompanied by old, real home video, like shot in the writer's room while people are playing the game they're about to describe. Clip one.
We were sent these soft vinyl, like a baseball. We're sitting there in rewrites, and Bob is like undoing the stitching. It took him all day. And he finally unraveled the thing. It was very quickly discovered that it would throw this shit really hard at the wall. It would stick. And so Jack Handy and Odenkirk invented this game.
The idea that was to hit the goo with the dart.
No. God, no. Jesus, Conan.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking of old goo.
Yes, old goo. You throw the darts in a pattern to deflect the goo. So that, and you create either a shunt or a fence. There were different terms for the different types of barriers.
I've never seen a one dart stopper.
It's like 1 a.m. and everyone's having a great time. And it's just, they pan around the room and I'm just like this. I'm just looking at my script and just.
Yes. The equivalent of the royal flush was to create what's called a cradle, where you'd create like a semicircular pattern of darts so the goo would roll into it and get trapped.
Great fucking trap.
But you could also slow the goo down and give another player time to cradle it.
You realize it's not a real sport.
Well, tell that to the American Goo Federation.
This is exactly what I'm here for in a documentary like this, is like, what is the stupidest thing you did in your time on the show? And it's that. And like seeing the video and how serious they all are, like truly about goo ball, is so funny. And there's also this. This is from when Norm Macdonald took over Weekend Update. Downey had been fired and Norm basically like had him rehired to write Update with him. He was the head writer of Update during that time, which was also a relevant, a very newsy time in the mid-90s. Here's a montage of some of the jokes they did then. Clip two.
Was O.J. Simpson high on speed the night of the murders? Absolutely not, said defense attorney Johnny Cochran today. And a simple test of any of O.J.'s blood found at the crime scene will prove it.
Hey, Norm, what's up? It's O.J.
Oh, O.J. O.J. Simpson's new fitness video was released this week. Oh, no, O.J. has struck again. How about that? It was revealed this week that defense lawyer Johnny Cochran once abused his first wife. In his defense, Cochran said, hey, at least I didn't kill her like some people I know.
So... wow. There's a lot about that. Oh. Anyway, I'm not sorry I watched it, but truly, like, you have to be right in the zone of liking Downey stuff. And it actually is astounding how many of the sketches you remember that he wrote. And just a sidebar about the Adam Pally special, Sarah, which I also watched. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly just him doing dad rock, but it's not really a comedy special either. So unless you really love him, no matter what he's doing, don't watch it. It is extremely self-indulgent. That said, David Krumholtz does appear in it, apparently singing, but not on any songs that you hear. So that's also frustrating.
Okay.
For my plug, the Again With This Patreon campaign continues. We have a lot of great stuff happening in October, not only the various horror movies that we're talking about that are related to Dawson's Creek, but also Sarah has an interview with Rob Nagel, who is a star on the show for 4 episodes. That's coming this week. And then lots more holiday programming for Thanksgiving and Christmas yet to come. So againwiththispodcast.com/campaign to get in that Patreon and hear lots of good stuff.
All right, Margaret, what do you got for us?
So I have been watching a lot of television with my boyfriend, and it is a real treat because up until now, he has not really consumed much of what he calls high quality scripted programming.
Okay.
So he's kind of a blank slate for me. I need to pay some attention to what he won't sleep through.
Mm-hmm.
And what doesn't trigger a trauma from his advertising past.
Mm.
And what we found that was incredibly successful is all 7 seasons of The Good Wife.
Mm-hmm.
And also at least there are 5 or 6 seasons of The Good Fight. It's hard to remember because some of them are so short.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, y'all, they hold up great. Those are still a real banger thing to watch. You're going to be triggered a lot by The Good Fight because it goes there.
Mm-hmm.
Any place you might go from Trump's election to today, it goes there and it goes hard. The entire final season is set in a city that is like besieged by constant riots. So they're just coming in out of tear gas streets all the time. And you're like, wow, it's like I'm looking in a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So just if you've been wondering where could I find 12 seasons of television I haven't already seen that I would enjoy, that pairing I highly recommend. Or if you made it partway through one of them and then stopped, go back. Be a completist. It's worth it. It's worth your time. So there's that. And then I'm going to do something a little bit more recent. I added this to the doc while we were recording, and specifically, I've been watching a little bit of the newest season of Love is Blind.
I've heard it's great.
in Denver. I'm like four episodes in, and it is certainly better than the previous season of Love is Blind UK, where everybody was just like too reasonable. Mm. I was like, well, there's nothing to watch here. Mm-mm. You're all reasonably deciding not to get married to somebody you've known for a month.
No, that's not what I'm here for. I'm here for you to be crazy.
No. Give me that altitude sickness decision making.
Yeah. There's a lot of altitude sickness decision making in Love is Blind Denver, but particularly mm-hmm. the quality that leapt out at me so much that I actually went on Blue Sky and did a blue skeet.
Chris, quite a mess, as I understand.
Yeah. It's like every single person in the cast has a Lyft driver energy, right? Where like you get in and you don't immediately get back out, right? Like they seem warm, gregarious, like they're not immediately making decisions you question. But then, like, you're like, are they high? Like, they're driving fine, but I don't feel safe anymore. Like, I no longer feel safe. I no longer feel confident in the decisions they're making. They're talking to you so much more than you want them to. And mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, they're like talking about, like, what would you do, you know, if your kid was LGBTQ? Do you think it's a fad? And you're like, oh, I don't want to have this conversation even with people I know and love, let alone with you, a Lyft driver. Uh-huh. And every conversation in the pods feels like that to me. Just feels like two Lyft drivers talking to each other through a wall. You're like,
Do I think anything
resulting from this is going to be a successful marriage? No, but with Lyft drivers, who can say?
Mm-hmm.
Do I think it is going to be a very successful and gripping season of Love is Blind? Yes. And I'm thrilled. And I only hope that Love is Blind Boston, which I believe is the next season,
oh wow,
can bring something this chaotic to the table.
I think you got the next format, though. It is a Lyft car with like a solid divider
in the middle, like a Lyft share, a ride share.
Yeah, in the middle. It's like a portable pod.
Bride share. That's what you could call it. Bride share.
Ooh. This week or next week sees the premiere of the latest season of Married at First Sight, which is moving to Peacock as of this season, season 19, and is taking place in Austin. I've already lived through the Austin season of Love is Blind, so looking forward to which parts of the city they befoul. Can't wait.
Mm-hmm. and if you enjoyed hearing any of this from me, you can find more of my social media content chiefly at Instagram.com/MrsFridayNext. But every once in a while, I do have a television-specific opinion I need to air, and then I do it at BlueSky.com/MrsFridayNext. I don't know how you construct a blue ski address.
People will figure it out. You just search for it. You'll get your name.
You can find my blue skeets there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting, what do you got?
I am talking about Task.
Task!
Mm-hmm. Woo, 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 woo.
Force. Anyway, we talked about Task on Extra, Extra Hot Great back in September. I did watch to the end. I did have a few notes. Overall, it's very good. I liked it a great deal. It's not as good as Mayor of Easttown. Of course, same creator, Brad Inglesby. Maybe it's because Mayor of Easttown brought Inglesby and his team the ability to deflect notes about things like a too meditative pace or a somewhat self-indulgent approach to episode construction. I would have preferred a slightly tighter narrative, a little less time spent on shots of late summer foliage, a little less obvious Emmy baiting with certain scenes and monologues. Some of the backstory for Tom and his family was too baroque. Some of the actors didn't get enough to do for my taste, by which I mean Martha Plimpton. Please spin her character off somehow. Mm-hmm. She is a badass delight. I love her. But these are all very good actors. Some of them I had never seen in anything before. Tom Pelfrey is Robbie. Amelia Jones is Maeve. Very, very good. Excited to spend more time with them on future things. There were a couple that got to like be leads functionally. Jamie McShane, for instance. Like, it was a little sort of trying to invest in a biker uncle is like not necessarily a lift that everyone is going to want to undertake, but he is really good. And there were some ideas there about finding family, whether it's the communities that you create or refinding your family of origin and sort of actively choosing them every day, the management of grief, all of that I thought was handled
bittersweetly and well. And I won't lie, I find that accent nostalgic and wonderful. And most of the people in my family of origin who could manage to get 28 vowels into the word Stroudsburg are gone now. And this is kind of a, like, opens a window to when they were still around. That won't be true for everyone. And this can be really dark, but it ended on a sort of up note exactly, but sort of trending upwards. And I appreciated that it was a well-told story, didn't drag on for 10 episodes. And apparently there are discussions about a season two task even forcier. I think that would be a mistake, but no one listens to me. And that's probably wise. Speaking of not listening to me, it's not always something that you should avoid doing. I review true crime at bestevidence.fyi. I do that with my esteemed colleague, Eve Beatty, and we have a bunch of stuff up this week, including upcoming October true crime documentaries, this Copaganda oral history book that I was reading on the subway that literally cleared out a whole three top on the R train, so... That one simple trick, if you want to see it on the subway, read a, you know, really bright red, aggressively fonted book about cops and don't put a post-it on it that says it's for work, which I also consider doing. Anyway, all that and 6.5 years more of our true crime reviews is at bestevidence.fyi.
All right, here's what's coming up on our shows in the coming week. This Friday on Extra Extra Hot Great, it is the Forcening Pool, and it's going to be a spoopy Forcening. Did I say that right? Spoopy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Halloween Wars is the show we'll be watching and discussing. That is available to all club members. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club. If you're not a member, you can join on Patreon, or you can join directly on Apple Podcasts. And then come back here, EHG Prime. 1 week from today, we'll be talking about It, : Welcome to Derry, with horror expert Josh Gondelman.
He will talk about it, but he is doing this under duress. Yeah. He was like, I don't know if this is going to be too scary.
He's like, I don't want to watch this.
Thank you so much.
It's too scary. And Tara's like, tough beans. No. You have to come on the show.
I said... just one. And he said, I can handle one. And we'll find out if he can next week.
And then Tara said, tough beans town. And he said, no, I'll do It. I don't want to do Boston Blue.
He is, in fact, from Boston as well.
If you'd given me a choice between the two, I think I probably still would have chosen Boston Blue for the same reason Josh did not want to do It, : Welcome to Derry. So I appreciate you deciding to give the other nicest person from Boston that assignment.
Mm-hmm. You're so welcome.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices. With beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.
Right.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week, it's Never Not Mike.
Hello, Extra Hot and Great. This is Never Not Mike. I am a new listener and an even newer member. When I submitted some questions to better understand the show, I also asked, how in the hell is Mad Men's The Suitcase not in the Extra Hot Great Canon? You all seemed equally surprised it wasn't and suggested I should submit it. While this seems like not much of a challenge, I mean, I can literally say my pitch is that it's the suitcase episode of Mad Men, and it should get in. But I will accept the challenge in the spirit of the show and try to show it the respect it deserves. So why Mad Men Season 4, Episode 7, The Suitcase Belongs in the Canon? Let's start with the obvious. This is the Mad Men episode that critics, fans, and even the show's own cast routinely point to as its crown jewel. It is the moment a great show reached its apex, and it's exactly halfway through the show, It is episode 46 of 92. It's intimate, it's devastating, it's unexpectedly funny, and distills everything the series does well. Character, atmosphere, subtle symbolism, into a tight, nearly real-time character study with the two leads. It's May 1965. The Ali knocks out Liston fight is that night, and Peggy won't be attending her own birthday dinner because Don has dragged her into staying late to crack a Samsonite campaign. He's avoiding something. A phone call from California that he knows will confirm the death of Anna Draper. Peggy is avoiding going out to an increasingly frustrated boyfriend and a mother who still doesn't understand her choices. The suitcase, the literal suitcase, is just Samsonite's product, but here it becomes a catch-all symbol for everything these two characters are lugging around. For Don, it's the unprocessed grief over Anna, the shame of a stolen identity, and his desperate need to keep moving so he doesn't have to unpack his past. His dream of Anna holding a suitcase is her silently telling him he's still carrying her with him, even if he doesn't want to open that baggage. For Peggy, the weight of being underestimated, the rumors about how she got her job by sleeping with Don, and the private pain of giving up her child, and the absence of anyone in her personal life that appreciates what she is doing in her work. She too hauls around an invisible luggage that affects every relationship in her life. Midway through the night, Peggy, so far always Don's underling, pushes back against his dismissive treatment of her ideas. His response, "That's what the money's for," is one of Mad Men's most quoted lines. On the surface, it's a boss reminding his employee that criticism is part of the job. For Don, the line is a deflection. He's not just telling her she's paid to take criticism. He's warning her, "Don't expect me to comfort you. That's not my role." Yet by the episode's end, he completely violates that idea. He breaks down in front of her, seeks her comfort, tries to drunkenly defend her honor in a fight, and lets her be there for him. For Peggy, hearing that line is a challenge. It's Don telling her, if you want to play in the big leagues, you have to take the hits. She absorbs it, pushes back in her own way, and by morning, she is not just his subordinate. She's his peer in the work and his emotional partner. That shift shows the emotional journey of the night, from transactional hierarchy to mutual vulnerability. For the show itself, the Samsonite pitch they finally crack comes down to the Ali Liston fight photo. It's a knockout, but also a frozen moment in time, just like the unresolved emotional moments both characters carry from their pasts. The best they can do is pack those moments neatly and move forward. But now they know that the other also has their own baggage to carry, and they are willing to be there for one another, if only in their own stunted ways. By the end, the suitcase isn't unpacked, but they've at least peeked inside each other's. Mad Men is usually a great show. The suitcase is not a typical Mad Men episode. It's better. It strips away the ensemble, the multiple subplots, and the bustling world of advertising to lock two characters in a room and make them face the heaviest suitcases in their lives. It gives some of the show's sharpest barbs, most aching silences, and one of television's most nuanced depictions of platonic love. It's an episode about what we carry, who helps us shoulder, and the rare relief of finding someone who will sit with you all night if that's what it takes, while you unpack just enough to keep going. If these points aren't resonant enough, let me remind you that this is the night Duck tried to take a dump in Don's chair, although it was actually Roger's office. It is also the first time we discover the beginnings of Sterling's gold, the first ramblings of which inform us Bert Cooper has no testicles. So when you are faced with not knowing quite how to celebrate this achingly perfect chapter and a shining example of quality television, try to remember the half-drunkenly shouted paraphrase from a red-faced Don Draper. That's what the cannon's for.
Thank you, Never Not Mike. Margaret, please start us off. What did you think of the episode and of Never Not Mike's argument?
I think Never Not Mike's argument is perfect, save for one thing. I would have loved it if he could have called it a bottle episode, specifically because I would have felt the rage. Catherine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I was thinking her blood too. Would have spiked
to troll
somewhere.
Her. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Just to troll her.
Yes.
For her 40th birthday surprise party, we got pencils made that said, "This is a bottle episode." And
one of them is buried in your heart right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, exactly. But more seriously, on the actual merits of the case, I felt silly picking this from the list of possible ones because it just feels like it's been like I'm just peeling tape off of the list where like it's already been ingrained this whole time. Because this is truly, it's one of the best episodes of Mad Men of all time. But I have not revisited Mad Men pretty much since it went off the air. And God, was it a welcome thing to step back into from Mrs. Blankenship, the secretary.
The Hellcat.
Yeah.
The Hellcat, truly master of perversion.
Queen of perversions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Queen of perversions. Just to have her in the first half, and I had forgotten that that reveal was contained in the second, so it hit with all the same impact it hit the first time. Just the throwaway bits that are like that to the actual like meat of the two-hander that Peggy and Don get to do with one another here. It shows so, so effectively why that TV show is as beloved as it is as respected as it is. And I really appreciate that in the central fight that produces the iconic line, that's what the money is for, neither of them is 100% right and neither of them is 100% wrong. Mm-hmm. Don does need to treat Peggy better, but he is right that like that ad was his idea, right? And that it is appropriate for him to get the credit for it. So I loved it. I don't have a lot more to say in addition to Never Not Mike's excellent, although insufficiently trolly case.
I'll go next. Agree with Mike straight down the line, starting with, I really don't have to do much. You don't, but you did a lot. And I respect the mm-hmm. argument that you made. This was spectacularly argued. Very tight. Mm-hmm. Clip free. What I had forgotten, because like Margaret, I haven't revisited the show since it was on either. I had forgotten how much episode there is after the fight. Like, yeah. That's not even really the climax of the episode. Nope. It's like in the first half, practically. There is so much to like. Mike is right. It is unexpectedly funny. The stuff that we talked about too. But like Randy Heller, fucking Daniel's mother from The Karate Kid as Miss Blankenship, just casually telling Don Rico's like, someone called while you were in the toilet. Like, she's just so wrong for the environment.
There's
so
a time difference, you know.
So right, so though. And every scene with Don and Peggy is perfect. The way they set up, you know, their season one conflict as well, or, you know, the long ago shame of Peggy's secret pregnancy, which it seems like it is like what Don told her right after she delivered, which is it will surprise you. It will amaze you how much this never happened, or whatever the line is, something to that effect. And it seems to be true because she runs into Trudy in the bathroom and now Trudy is pregnant with a baby she is keeping from the same man. And it's like there's no sort of twinge from Peggy. It's just like, here's my colleague's wife. I'll be nice. There's a reason not to. And like, I won't say there's something to be said for compartmentalization because it doesn't seem to be doing Don well in this episode, really. But, you know, he does pull it together at the end. He doesn't look like he ever puked on his shirt and continued in the office without going home. So he's figured out some things and not others. But my favorite part of it is when he presents the idea to Peggy at the end and she starts critiquing it the way he was critiquing hers. And it's like, this is the crux of what they've arrived at now. Like Never Not Mike said, he thinks of her as a peer, but he's as hurt when he thinks she is insufficiently appreciating him as much as she does when it's the other way around. And I enjoyed that moment where she's just finally like, yep, it's great. We can pick on it later because they have reached a new understanding in their relationship. I'm amazed also to hear that it's the exact midpoint of the series, because I won't say it's all downhill from here, but they never reached these heights again. This is a wonderful episode.
You know, it's a real shame they couldn't bottle this magic.
Going hard.
That was Margaret, not us, Catherine. Okay, so Sarah.
And that was the last time we had Catherine on as a guest. This was delightful. I was really struck by how many like legendary lines or scenes are in this that I forgot. Like, you remember that's what the money is for, but I had forgotten that this was also like, he's just sort of like there on the couch with Chunder on his shirt. And she's like, how long are you going to go on like this? I forgot the Ali Liston fight was involved. And for this show, like, I think if this had been in season six, that parallel would have been much more heavy-handed mm-hmm. than it is here, where, like, you're talking about two heavyweights. It's two different styles of fighting. That is referred to in passing and not underlined too much. What they bring into that, that's what the money is for, fight is also, like, you get context from the fight about the years that have led to this fight. But it's not too much exposition, like, you know, as you know, when you stole this idea, and then like she just refers to it and then keeps going. It is fairly passive aggressive on her side and dismissive on his, which is in character. And there are these two heavyweights, like in their field, but also as actors, kind of, you know, doing their thing in the ring. And then there's Roger Sterling fucking doing bits in a payphone booth about how boring it is to spend time with people in recovery. And he's like, and then they start crying. And then you can hear Duck's ice clinking and the ways that alcohol is and is not helping people manage their suitcases is woven through the whole thing. I thought the ghost of Anna was for this kind of thing. Like, it's always a risk to do that. I thought it was well done. It really is just so well written and performed. And there's all these moments from like Ida Blankenship not knowing which direction the time difference goes. Stan being like, have you been farting in here? Actually, she's just been like crying and sulking, but she's like the one woman, like can't let anything show. Mm-hmm. We just talked about a Jack and Bobby episode. Remember that thing? Oh, and wow. There was Jack in the, you know, being a just like white, you know, nepo fail son asshole in this scene, but they don't really dwell on it because that's kind of the entire show. But I was impressed with this presentation. Like, thank you for not clipping certain bathroom scene, because wow, it just really seems like prestige shows love to make me suffer with the fucking barfing. But it was worth it. And, you know, as a man once said, that is what the money is for. So thank you so much. I'm glad we're finally, like, actually processing the paperwork on this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they cut to Peggy's official boyfriend, because she's also sort of having an affair with Duck on the side. But when we cut to Mark at the restaurant, it's just like him. Like, the way he is not it, like, just does not fit in this world, is not the guy for her, is clearly not going to last past this episode. It's like, oh, buddy, you just have no idea. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say. Dave.
When the junior ad team goes to Don to pitch their first Samsonite idea, it's this whole football thing with Joe Namath as the spokesperson, sort of. And Don just ends it with endorsements are lazy, which he's absolutely right. That is 100%. Every time you get an endorsement, it's because somebody gave up along the line. Mm-hmm. Other things of note, Duck's horrible feet. The soles of his feet are disgusting.
So leathery.
They truly are haunting. Yep.
I don't know what's worse, Ducks or Jackson Lamb from Slow Horses. It's a real tight competition there. One of the just throwaway lines or moments I really enjoy is when the junior ad team is in their cubicle area and they're talking about ideas or not talking about ideas. And one of them just says to Danny, like, I hate your neck. It's the kind of neck that I wish I had a James Bond blow dart to stick in it. It's just like, all right. Somebody telling Peggy that 26 is still ... very young. One thing, though, I wasn't sure of, one piece of dialogue I was wondering about, when Peggy finally tells Dawn that it's her birthday, Dawn just like takes a beat and says, oh, now I'm supposed to feel like crap. Would that have been, now I feel like crap? Would that have been in the language back then?
I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there, but I don't think that it didn't hit my ear wrong personally.
Okay. No. Yeah. Mine neither.
All right. Okay. But yes, it's nice to finally now be able to say, yes, it's in the canon. It wasn't just a mass delusion we all had that it was definitely in there and we forgot to put it in the list.
Well, now wait, we haven't voted yet.
Okay. Well, that's true. So let's do that right now. Margaret, the suitcase, canon worthy or not?
Yay. Canon worthy.
Tara.
Yay.
Sarah.
Like a roach in the Parthenon. Yes, sir.
All right. Me too. So... Mad Men, Season 4, Episode 7, The Suitcase. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover the winner and a loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
Yeah, trying to keep it Boston themed. Speaking of hyena sport bean eaters, Michael Fassbender, who is not one, will be playing Joseph Kennedy Sr. in Netflix's series on the Kennedy dynasty, which, like, I first read that and was like, you know what? Totally. Like, you get those little slightly too close together, perfectly round glasses from the 20s. It's on. Mm-hmm. Can't wait.
And who is the loser, Tara?
loser is Rockman Dunbar, formerly of 911. He got fired from 911 because he refused to get the COVID vaccine in 2021, which was the mandate at the time. Later, I believe, either he or his wife ran for SAG president on the anti-vaccine like platform, basically. So he claimed a religious exemption from getting it because it was the vaccine is not of God, and took it all the way to federal court, where Disney's lawyer was like, basically, this you, and listed the 37 other medications he is on. And anyway, he lost. His claim was rejected. Yes, he sued the company in 2022, alleging that the production failed to accommodate his belief in the tenets of the Congregation of Universal Wisdom. And an 8-member federal jury found unanimously that that was bullshit, actually. And in court, he yelled, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God," according to Variety. And it not only lost, but lost spectacularly and made a scene. So sucks to be him.
That's bullshit.
That's what he said.
He did.
Hey, girl.
Speaking about that was bullshit. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
It's game time.
It's gotta be game time.
Welcome back, everybody, to Game Time. This is the 9th of the season. Our scores are Tara with 4.5 points. If Tara can get half a point today, she will win the season. Sarah has 1.5 points. Value guests have 2 whole points. Today, we are playing Get Margaret There, in which you, the non-Margaret people, must get Margaret there. It's basically Password with Margaret as the guesser. Tara and Sarah will take turns giving Margaret one-word clues to one-word TV-related answers. To remind you of the rules, clues cannot rhyme with the password, cannot be a homonym or a proper noun, and you cannot use gestures.
Got it.
If Margaret answers after your clue, Tara and Sarah, you get a point. If you can't help Margaret and we reach 10 collective hints, no points are awarded and a non-point punishment will be given to both players.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
jeez.
But none for me?
No. I would never, Margaret. Unless you want to.
No, okay. Thank you.
Tell you what. I'll let you know what the punishment is. You can buy in or not.
Deal.
Whoever has the most points at the end of the game wins. If Margaret gets half of the questions correct, she also wins. So we could have two winners today. Let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with Tara.
All right. So that just means who starts the clues for each one. Okay. We got 10 clues, assuming it's not going to take forever to do. Mm-hmm. No steel mills, no equalizer challenge zones. Are we ready to play Get Margaret There?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get me there.
This is Dave with a quick post-production note. If you'd rather know the answers before people start doing the clues and the guessing, there is an answer guide in the show notes. All right, Tara and Sarah have been given the one-word answer. They must provide one-word clues that do not go against all the rules that I have mentioned. Tara, what is your first clue?
Internet.
All right, Margaret, one answer per clue, please.
Email.
Sarah.
Watching?
Netflix?
Platform.
Streaming.
Yay!
Streaming nice. Is correct. First point goes to Tara. Nicely done, everybody. That's how you do it. Clue number two coming at you, starting with Sarah.
Kingdom.
Disney?
Dragons.
Thrones?
Winter.
Stark?
Country?
Oh, shit. Okay, I know what you're trying to get me to. What is it? What is the name of that country? You guys don't understand the way that I just released all information I had.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're very familiar. All right, we're going to take that as a pass.
Yeah, I think that's safe.
East.
Okay. I feel like that means it's starting with an E. I can't believe the way this is so gone from my brain. Nope, that's not getting me there, but right. Thank you for your effort.
Moving on. Tara?
Opposite.
West. Westeros! Westeros!
Westeros is correct, yes.
I feel so sorry.
I think Sarah could have got you there if she put the right amount of opposite mustard on her.
That's how it goes sometimes.
It's you all get stacked, it on the back, you know?
Yeah. All right, it's 2 for Tara, none for Sarah yet. So lots of game to go. Headphones off, please, Margaret.
Sure.
All right, we are back to Tara for our first clue.
Ratings. Nielsen.
Yes, right away. Bing, bang, boom. Kidding. Sarah didn't even get a chance. Dang. All right, next one is...
Christ.
All right, let's see if Sarah can get it in one.
No, definitely can't.
Remember, Sarah, you can put all the mustard you want on it.
Mm-hmm. I know. I'm trying to figure out which mustard is going to work on the word.
Mm-hmm. Brown.
Which mustard is going to get Margaret there?
Couch.
Friends?
Stairs? Cosby?
Back to Sarah.
Moving.
All right, let's review the clues. We've got
couch, stairs, moving.
Yeah.
Escalator?
Back to Tara.
I don't know if this would count as a synonym, I guess, but adjustment?
That's fine.
Okay.
Deep in thought.
Yeah, I'm sure when I hear the answer, I'm going to be like, obviously, but I'm getting nothing.
All right.
Antenna?
Back to Sarah.
Dinosaurs.
That's good.
Dinosaurs.
Or is it just leading her so far astray? What the fuck is this show?
Oh, God. Flintstones? Turn? I have no idea. I'm beginning to wonder if I've ever watched television before in my life.
All right. Pass. Go to Sarah.
Pass.
Okay.
Sitcom.
Okay, well, that's reassuring. I feel like
it's not Terra Nova.
I've been guessing in that direction. Simpsons?
Stuck.
See, the problem with dinosaurs is all I get is the sitcom Dinosaurs, and I know it can't be that because you've said dinosaurs.
Right.
Frasier.
All right, we got to be getting close to 10 now.
That was 6, I think.
No way that was 6.
Who started this round?
Sarah.
Okay, so that's 7, I think.
Okay.
If I'm going... No, all right. Yeah, that was 6. This will be 7.
All right.
Okay.
That feels wrong.
Landing.
I think Margaret's going to need more.
Paleontologist,
says Tara.
Okay, I have a vague recollection. I didn't I already say Friends?
You did say Friends. It was not correct.
Okay.
I mean,
he's a paleontologist.
That was not the correct answer.
Ross?
Quiet.
Damn it.
Not Ross. Sarah.
Direction?
Oh, God. Pivot?
Pivot! Yeah! There we go. Pivot.
I'm so sorry. Woo. I have not watched Friends since I was a child.
It's okay.
Pivot.
It's okay. We got there.
All right. Let's pivot to the next question.
Mm-hmm.
Headphones off, Margaret. All right. We're starting with Tara.
Yep.
This is our halfway mark.
Mm-hmm. Boss.
Boss.
Baby.
Love that. Producer.
Producer.
Apprentice?
Back to Tara.
Creator.
Showrunner.
Showrunner is correct, yes. All right, that is halfway. I know the scores, but let's get them officially.
Okay. Sarah has 1. I have 4.
All right. It's going to be hard to catch up, but it's possible. We're going to start with Sarah. We're going to ask Margaret to take her headphones off. All right, let's go. First clue for number 6. This is number 6.
Is rom-com considered a single word?
Oh, well,
I think that's
if
okay.
There's a hyphen in the middle, yes.
Rom-com.
Okay, rom-com. Mindy.
Hippie.
Okay. Dharma?
Fuck
Holy
me.
Shit!
ridiculous.
I can't believe that worked.
That was
good.
Wow.
Fucking hell.
So you thought I was going to get pivot so fast and got Dharma that quickly.
Oh, I was like, we're coming at it from Dharma bums, Dharma initiative.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Margaret's a land of contrast. All right. For real. Headphones off, please. All right. We're starting with Tara for our next round.
Mm-hmm.
One word clue.
Exchange.
Swap. Wouldn't have been swap. Sorry, Tara.
Could have been
event.
Swap.
Event.
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 Crossover.
Yes, crossover is correct.
Nicely done. Nicely
done.
All right.
Margaret came out to play in the second half.
Wow, took a village. Woo.
All right, we're starting with Sarah. Number 8.
Pump.
Hump.
Hump.
Dangerous clue, if you ask me.
I know you're not giving me Joe Camel because that's two words. It's not especially television related. But let's just go with, no, Camel. Yeah, sure, Camel.
It's not Camel.
Okay. Uki.
Uki. Hump Uki. My favorite Star Wars bounty hunter.
Wednesday.
Wednesday is the correct answer, yes. That's
hot damn.
Well done.
Nicely done. There's two more. Let's play them out. Here is our penultimate clue. First out of the gate on this one is Tar.
Superimposed.
Superimposed. Wow.
Chiron.
Holy
Jesus
shit.
Should I leave?
Margaret, I think we should get married.
Yeah. That was amazing.
Maybe.
Wait, what?
Look, I should be so lucky, Tara.
All right. Last one, Margaret. Take your headphones off. All right. Here comes the last set of clues. This one is going with Sarah first, right? Yes.
Yes.
Pacifier.
Oh, Maggie?
Maggie. Yes. Correct.
I really wanted to give that one to Sarah.
No.
And that's so elegant. You brought it to Margaret.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's get the regulation scores, please.
Regulation scores are Sarah with 3, me with 7.
All right, and Margaret gets a point for getting over half of them, but also Tara gets a point, which means that we have 2 winners.
Tara.
But also, Tara wins the season.
History repeats itself. Try and you succeed.
Yes. The best around. Oh, the music went. Oh, no. Nothing's ever going to keep you down. Oh, no.
Keep going.
The music industry's come knocking on our door. God damn it. It was bound to happen eventually.
Speaking of the Karate Kid.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We traveled to Beantown for the next chapter in the Blueiverse, Boston Blue, before going around the dial with stops at Downey Wrote That, The Good Wife, The Good Fight, Love is Blind, and Task. Never Not Mike unpacked Mad Men's The Suitcase, finally. For the canon, we crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara and Margaret were the winners of this week's Game Time. Next up, October's Forcing Pool on Friday's Extra Extra Hot Great, and it, Welcome to Dairy, back here in 1 week's time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Arrieta,
let's go somewhere darker.
Sarah D. Punting.
Have you been farting in here?
And Margaret H. Willison.
Pivot!
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
So that's it?
Yep. Good night.
Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, we help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Our doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true health starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at AbilityCairo.com. That's AbilityCairo.com.
During the Right Rug Flooring Anniversary Sale, we're celebrating 91 years of the guaranteed lowest prices with beautiful carpet with a lifetime stain warranty starting at $219 a square foot installed with pad. And luxury vinyl starts at $399 a square foot installed. Unbeatable prices and 24-month special financing available with approved credit. Schedule a free in-home appointment with our flooring experts at RITERUG.com. Right Rug Flooring's Anniversary Sale.